Welcome to the Student of the Game Fire Podcast with your host, Danny B. Today's guest is Scott Thompson, 43 years of volunteer and career experience, fire chief for the Colony Fire Department in Texas, husband, father of two sons, which also serve in the fire service, published author, instructor at FDIC since 2002, has held numerous leadership roles while coaching fire officers and firefighters for the last 25 years. The list of accomplishments and accolades could go on and on, but one of the most important factors is this: America's fire chief, who has never forgotten his roots, supports the role of the mission-first mindset, the men and women of respective organizations, and always being cowboy ready. With that, I present Mr. Scott Thompson.
My name is Scott Thompson. I'm currently the fire chief in the Colony, Texas. I got in the fire service. I always wanted to be a firefighter, number one. I grew up just north of New York City, so I always wanted to be a fireman. And I had the opportunity to go to college, but it was always with the intent that I'm going to be a fireman and do something else. And so my first experience to anything formal is I went to Texas A&M University in 1981 as part of their recruit training program. In Texas, you have to be a certified firefighter. So I went to Texas A&M University. I got certified as a structural firefighter and started volunteering for Brazos County Volunteer Fire Department. They're called something different today. So I got my college degree. I got a bachelor's. And when I got out of college, I was very fortunate. I graduated in December of 85. And in January of 86, I was offered a job by the Plano, Texas Fire Department after taking a few fire department tests. So I started my paid career in Plano, Texas. And I was very fortunate. As soon as I came out of their academy, I was assigned to special operations on the hazmat team on Engine 22. And so I spent 10 years there. It was a great experience. But I've always been kind of chasing a vision, what I thought being a suburban fireman should look like. So I had the opportunity. I'm very passionate about training. I had the opportunity to go to Arlington, Texas, as their one and only outside training chief. And I spent just a little bit of time there, not because I didn't like Arlington. It was a great place. But the way that their city works, because I came from the outside, I was classified as a civilian. And even though I, you know, got to go to calls and had gear, it just wasn't the same. But while I was there, I was recruited to go to Athens, Texas, or to put in for the fire chief's position. And I'll be honest, it was never a goal of mine to be a fire chief. But, you know, I was somebody who wanted to leave an impression on the American Fire Service and make a difference and move the needle. And I realized that the only way I was going to be able to do that was to put myself in that position. So I became the fire chief in Athens, which is a very small city in East Texas. It's about 90 minutes from the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex, one station department. I was there for about 4 years, and I got recruited to come back to the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex. While I was in Arlington and Plano, I was also a volunteer in Argyle, Texas, and I was a part paid guy in Lake Cities. I was a company officer there and then a shift commander. And so I was doing all of that. So I had some experience with Lake Cities. While I was in Athens as the fire chief, I got recruited to come back to Lake Cities, where I'd been a part-time guy, to be their fire chief. And really to take them from a volunteer organization to a career organization. So I came in and did that. We covered four cities, started the first ALS transport ambulance system in the area. And so I was there for about 4 or 5 years, and I was having coffee with one of my mentors right across the lake in Louisville, Rick Lasky. And while I enjoyed being a fire chief, my passion is still very much training, but I was having coffee with Rick, who is one of my mentors and life coaches and friends. And he told me his training chief was retiring and asked if I knew anybody that would be interested to be his training chief. And without thinking about it, said, boy, I'd love to do that. He kind of in surprise said, you're willing to step down from a fire chief to the division chief of training? And I said, absolutely. So I spent the next 10 years with Rick Lasky as his training chief. It was great, outstanding. I learned a ton of things. We had a lot of fun. Louisville has a tremendous reputation here in the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex. They operate very similar to how we're operating in the colony. So I spent about 10 years with Rick, and I was eligible to retire. So I retired and then immediately took the job in the colony, Texas, where I'm the fire chief there. I've been there 17 years now, just starting 17. And five station apartment located just north of Dallas. And so I've been teaching at FDIC since 2002. Was teaching at a local community college starting in about 1986. So I've stayed heavily involved in teaching all kinds of things from hazmat to firefighter rescue to the recruit academy to some officer development stuff. And so that's about it. You're up to speed.
Okay. All right. With that being said, I'm going to kind of go backwards a little bit. So once you first got onto your first career department, was it from that moment when you stepped foot in the doors, did you try to find those individuals you wanted to emulate, those mentors you wanted to have?
Yeah, absolutely. And I had a great one. I had a couple of great ones. My first captain was very good. I've always, you know, I started getting Fire Engineering Magazine probably in the early 70s and was reading that. So I knew a lot of the big names in the fire service. You know, a lot of people that we hear about today were active and doing things. So yes, I always had this, I guess you would kind of model firefighter in my head, and I would seek out those people. And I had a great one in Plano. His name was Randy Stone. He was my senior man when I went there. Had a great captain and lieutenant. But yeah, I always looked for those people that shared the passion. And I'll be honest with you, it was kind of one of my disappointments is that I had to realize pretty quick, and this is before you had internet and all that other stuff, is that it was really hard to find people that had the same level of passion that I did for the fire service. And so if I found those people, I tried to hang around and learn from them. You know, a lot of people taught me a lot of great lessons very early, but yeah, I think I did that almost immediately. And the environment I went into, that was kind of set up for that because they were a very senior crew and they hadn't had a rookie at that firehouse in a long time. I was one of the first new guys they'd gotten in a long, long time. They were pretty dedicated to investing in me because they knew their success was going to be heavily dependent on my success. So they started investing in me pretty early. So I was pretty fortunate from that aspect.
Okay. And as well said, definitely, I mean, in today's fire service too, we got to find the ones that get us, because the ones that don't or aren't into the job like we would like, they kind of separate themselves from us, or, you know, they might have names for us. But I 100% agree with you have to find.
And there's a lot more of them than there are us, unfortunately. Right. And, you know, but I kind of embrace it now, Danny. You know, if somebody's critical of me and they're not doing as much as me or they're not as passionate as I am, I'm great with that. I'm okay. That means that I'm getting in their head a little bit, and they're either, you know, they're either feeling a little shame because they're not doing what they could have done. They've missed the opportunities that presented to them, or they just have egos and they just don't like anybody doing more than them. But, you know, I'm really okay with that. It took a long time to get there. I'm not going to say I've always been that way, but I figure if there's a force against you, then there's got to be something that you're doing that's disturbing them. And as long as it's not an integrity or character challenge, you know, if you're doing it to better the fire service, bring it on. I'm okay with that.
Okay. Well said. My next question for you, or my first question for you, will be, what does the term aggressive mean to you, Chief Scott Thompson?
Wow. Well, you know, I have been getting asked that question in a lot of different ways. So I've spent a lot of time thinking about it. So I base our success on two things: our capabilities, what we are able to do with what's been given to us. That's a fixed number. That's a given. A fire department only has what they have as far as personnel or lack of engines, ladders. Okay. So that's number one. Number two is the zero impact period. The time from when we show up on scene until we start solving the problems. So if you were to ask me, aggression comes in a lot of forms, right? Let's train aggressive. Let's have an aggressive problem-solving mindset. Let's have aggressive leadership that's always looking for solutions. All those things come together to be what we're really kind of talking about, is aggressive operations on the fire ground, right? But to have aggressive fire ground operations, you got to have an aggressive strategic plan, a culture that values aggression, aggressive training, and all these other things. So to me, aggression is maximizing the capability, maximizing the stuff that has been given to us and pushing it right up until the limit of reckless. Now, reckless looks very different in our eyes based on our experiences. So there's a component there of identifying what is reckless aggression and what is sensible aggression. The other part of aggression is how quickly we get to work. Like I said, that zero impact period. The minute we set the parking brake, we should be aggressively addressing the problems. I'll have that debate with anybody. Now, how we address that is going to be based on our capabilities, our level of training, the experience that they have with, we have with certain types of buildings. So to me, aggression is just aggressive problem solving, whatever the problem is. You know, if you look at the Blue Angels, you look at somebody who drives a race car at 200 miles an hour, you know, whatever extreme sport you want to look at, that person got there. And those are rich with risks. Running a race car, flying a jet is a thousand times riskier than fighting fire. If you look at all the systems and the energy and all that, yet through preparation, through training, through systems, through planning, through design, they have been able to teach humans to take risks at that level, flying a jet 18 inches apart from another jet, turning a race car at 200 plus miles an hour into a turn. So the same thing applies in the fire service. We train and we train and we train and we train to be professional firefighters. And so when we're performing at a high level, we're aggressively addressing problems, but that doesn't mean we're being unsafe. It doesn't mean we're being dangerous. It just means we have prepared and we've been able to compete with fire, rescue, and emergency medical problems at a very high level. And aggressiveness has to do with our mindset on risk management as far as risk acceptance versus risk avoidance. It has to do with how we manage time, urgency, and having a very fast fire ground tempo. And then looking at those capabilities and limitations. And if we're in our capability, man, we should have the throttle to the floor going as fast as this thing will go. But when we recognize our limitations, that's when we need to tap the brakes, reassess, reevaluate, call for help, whatever it is we have to do, and get back into our operational capability and cadence so that we can aggressively address those problems. So that's how I look at aggressiveness.
Okay. With that being said, with you being and anytime I get an actual like a fire chief on the podcast, I always like to ask, with aggressiveness can sometimes come a line of duty death, and no fire chief wants that. But how do you find that balance?
Line of duty deaths also come in non-aggressive departments.
Correct. Yes, sir.
They come in non-preparedness. So, you know, I've got two sons that are firefighters, so it's very personal to me. You know, I always say I would not make a decision or support an action that I would not be okay with my sons being involved in other words, governing by. I don't expect more from my firefighters than I would expect a chief to expect from my sons. Does that kind of make sense? So I'm kind of all in. So this is a very dangerous job. The best we can do is everything possible to prevent a line of duty death or a career ending injury. But there's always going to be that potential. And I mean, let's all face it. The riskiest place we work is on the roadway. It's not even in a burning building. The most dangerous place we put firefighters are on a roadway, because if we're students of building construction and fire behavior, we can, with a high degree of accuracy, if we have experience, if we've gone to some fires and we've turned those events into experiences and learned from them, we, with a high level of accuracy, can predict what a building and a fire is going to do. That's part of being a student. So the more we understand that, the more aggressive we can be. On a roadway, we have no idea what the next driver coming down the road is going to think. So we got to kind of separate that out. So the way that I look at it is, and this is my motivation every day, we go to the roof. We're pretty aggressive at cutting a vertical ventilation. we allow our firefighters to search off of a line. Now, those to me are two aggressive tactics in the eyes of some. I don't look at it that way, but some fire chiefs would say, oh, that's too aggressive or that's ultra aggressive. But we make that part of our culture, and then we train really, 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 really hard to be good at that. So God forbid we have a tragic event tonight and I lose a firefighter or a career-ending injury. I believe, and thank God I haven't been tested, but I believe I can look the media, my bosses, but more importantly, that family's loved ones in the eyes and said, listen, we did everything we could do. We spent the money. We did the training. We tried to buy the best of this and give you the best leaders and put tested policy in place. We did everything we could to prevent this, but this one won. This one got the best of us, and we paid the ultimate price. We weren't reckless. We weren't cowboys. We weren't without a purpose. It's just that this one won this time. And sometimes that happens. And if you look at how many times the firefighters in this country go out the door every day, our win-loss record is phenomenal. We get it right a whole lot longer than we get it wrong. But I mean, you look at the airline industry, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of flights take off and land every day. But if there's an airline crash today, everybody is going to assume that airline travel is not safe. There's always things that happen. And that doesn't mean it's okay. It's never okay to kill firefighters. But if you look at how often we're putting people in burning buildings, we get it right a whole lot of times. So there's a ton of things we can do to prevent that and still be aggressive problem solvers. So I would just say that's how I answered. I just make sure that the system is doing everything possible so that if we do have a bad fire experience, we can all look at ourselves and say, we didn't take any shortcuts. We weren't unnecessarily reckless or overly aggressive. This one just won.
Okay. Love it. Love hearing it. What is your take on recruitment and retention in the fire service? What do you think we're doing good at, and what do you think we can improve on?
Well, I think I think it's a societal thing. I think it's society. I think there's a generation coming into the workforce that doesn't want to do this job. They don't want to be carpenters. They don't want to be plumbers. They don't want to be welders. They don't want to be cops, firemen, or soldiers. So that's part of it. We're just, you know, our generation, when we were coming up, and I'm not referring that you're as old as me at all, but I'm just saying, you know, you're in this profession, you're not getting into it. You know, we were brought up that man, you want to be bigger than just the average. You want to do something special. You know, I know my parents were always saying, do whatever you want to do, but make a difference and be the best at whatever it is that you're doing. And so this is an opportunity that's attractive to a lot of younger men and women, but that's lost now. It's no longer in the moral values of, and this is white, black, green, orange. If you live in the mid cities or the outer city, it's just not that thing that people want to do anymore. It's just not that it had its time, I guess, if you will. And because of how things are perceived. So number one, I think that, so to answer the problem is, we got to go back to really redefining ourselves. And in today's fire service, not only when you go from department to department to department, do you see maybe a different in pay and benefits, but you see a huge difference in culture. So we got to create and sell a culture that's going to attract the type of person that we want to be in our organization. And we got to stop focusing on the numbers. Yeah, we may not get 1,000 or 100 apply for us anymore. We only may get 20, but because we were very good at marketing our mission and our culture, those 20 are the type of firemen that we want. So we've cut out all the ones that don't want to do this or don't want to do that. And so we have that. So I think every organization has a strength, everyone. And so you got to figure out what that is. And that's what you got to sell. And you got to put it out there. And you are going to attract the people that want that environment. Now, that's part of it. Then we got to live that. If we can't just say it, because the minute we recruit somebody and they get in our firehouse and find out that's not the case, that's going to get all over the fire service. So then in the firehouse, we got to live what we're selling. you know, we attract a ton of people in the colony because we sell quality training. So that attracts people who like to train. Now, not saying we're getting the best, not saying we're getting the worst, but we're not hiring people that don't like to train, because our reputation is you come here, you're going to train. So we're going to get those people. They're those people who like our engine and truck deployment model. Now, that's not for everybody, and I'm not saying it is, but we attract people who like that. They like to know if they're going to be riding a truck or they're going to be riding an engine, because they want to get really good at it. We have our single role paramedic program, and we have to do all these things because we can't compete with Plano and Frisco on pay. So we have to sell culture. And it's worked pretty good. But as we talked about at the beginning of this show, I think the pay separation now is getting to a point where we are starting to lose some people. And we've gone 15 years without it, and now we've lost some people because of pay. So I think there's a lot of things we can do. You know, the generation coming in, support programs are important. So we got to talk about mental health. And we got to talk about cancer prevention and healthy lifestyles, because that's so. So all those things, we got to figure out what we want to be. And then we got to put out information to attract that kind of person. And then when we get them here, we got to invest in them. No more. We're not just saying, you know, I remember I said, I just want a fire job. Just give me a fire job. You know, I don't care. As long as I'm a fireman, I don't care who's it's with. Those days are over. They pick and choose. I want to be this type of fireman, so I'm going to go to this organization. So there's a ton of things. I mean, obviously, firework is a huge motivator. There are firefighters who go to fire departments to fight, and God love them. That's a great reason. But we don't have any control over that, right? I can't. My fire marshal gets upset when I start suggesting more fires to recruit people. You know, but that's a huge motivator, firework. Pay and benefits is a big motivator. But a lot of times, a fire chief has very little say in it. So I can't really control. But what are the things I can control? What our workday looks like, you know, what we represent, what our mission is, our commitment to training, our commitment to aggressive tactics. All those things are the things that we can control. So we got to kind of decide what we want to be, and then we got to sell that and attract the type of person that wants to be a part of that organization.
Very well said. 100%. With that,
I'm not going to give you too many short answers. If you want short answers, you got the wrong guy on here.
No, you're fine.
Like this, if you want to cut me off.
You're fine. And so with you already talking about culture, this is a personal question I want to ask you. So you stated earlier, you really never had plans to be a fire chief, but you are, and you are a very well-known fire chief. With that being said, what made you want the colony and the culture to be the way it is today?
Okay, you froze for just a minute. So repeat that question, because you froze for just a second, if you would.
Okay. What made you want the culture of the Colony Fire Department to be the way it is today?
So, and again, this is just my vision. I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but I always had a vision of what I thought the suburban fire. I wanted to be a big city fireman. The cards didn't play out that way. You know, I didn't get to go to a Dallas or a Houston or an FDNY or Chicago, just like so. But I always had this vision of what being a firefighter should look like. And I've worked for a lot of organizations, as I mentioned. And then one of the things I failed to say, since 1986, at least once a year, I travel someplace in this country and go visit, you know, what I call a functional fire company, a busy, high performing fire company. And so I've looked and seen how those companies act, how they interact, and all those. And so prior to coming to the colony, I just really was taking it all this in and really trying to develop this vision of what I thought a fire department should look like, what letting firemen be firemen should look like, developing this vision. And then when I started learning about mentorship and learning about culture and learning more about leadership and supervision, I started to learn things to make this vision a reality. You know, hey, this can. So when I went into the colony, I had this idea, and the colony is a great organization. It was great before I got here. It'll be great after I leave. But being a fire chief means at the end of the day, I'm responsible. So I have to build a system that I'm comfortable with, because I've got a lot at stake. And so What we did is we created this document called the Excellence Vision and Professional Standards, which was really probably the chosen culture down on paper. We didn't look at it that way then, but because I was coming into a new organization and I've worked in some other organizations, and I'll be quite honest with you, it was kind of a shortcut. I kind of put my vision down on paper and I gave it to each of the shift commanders. And I said, you know, if you want to get inside my head, I'm not saying this is right. I'm not saying we can't debate this and talk about it and change it. But where I am at this point in time on this day, this is what I think we should look like. I think this is what we should want to be. One of the things that I heard when I was meeting with the men and women and asking them this question, what do you want to be? What do you want the Colony Fire Department to be? One of the things I heard repeatedly was they wanted to be respected. They worked a lot with the surrounding departments, made a lot of mutual aid fires, and they never felt respected. And I said, okay. So I had something to work with there. And so we, you know, I was always passionate about training. So that was a component of it. We wanted to be respected. Well, you know, to be respected at a fire department, it's not about words, it's about how you do. So we had to start training and buying functional equipment. And so all these things. And then, you know, I always had this idea. From a work design standpoint, I've always believed in the engine and truck deployment model. And not that the Quint concept's wrong. I don't buy it. I just, when you look at skill acquisition and skill retention and how to train firefighters to do what they do, you know, we're a very hands-on activity, occupation, whatever you want to call it. And so to me, that just didn't make sense. So really committing to engine work and truck work, I always saw results from that. So I was pretty passionate about that. So how do we take that to the next level? I always knew that firefighter paramedics didn't like riding an ambulance. And we always said, well, that's just part of the job. I get it. Some have to do that, but how do we make that a little bit better? Well, let's put people on our ambulance who love doing ambulance work. And own that and let our firefighters be firefighters again. So with all those little pieces, those were all kind of parts of the puzzle. And we just started kind of introducing them. And when we had momentum, we kept going. Where we felt resistance or it wasn't working, we stopped and we said, hey, okay, we're not gonna keep pushing that. Let's go back in this direction. So through all those things and then doing what we called the Colony Project and breaking the organization down so we fully understood it, we could see the many influences in an organization. So we were able to adjust this to get that or work on this to get, and we started to understand ourselves so that we had as much control, I guess, as you can have of our future. And then when we started hiring like-minded people who believed in that, we built two firehouses in a very short period of time. We doubled the size of our organization. We brought in a whole bunch of people who believed operational philosophy wise and what we were selling. And that just really made it all take off.
Which obviously it shows in today's fire service world, the culture of the Colony and, you know, how popular that department is. So
there's also luck. There's luck. You know, okay. When I got here, we didn't have a lot of development going on, and then Grandscape came in. So, you know, we started to get all these cool things happening. We went from these having to just worry about single families to high rises. So luck had a big part to do with it. Timing had a lot to do with it. The men and women that were in the organization played a big role in that transition and bringing a lot of people in. Everybody we brought in were from other fire departments. So we were kind of like a melting pot. You know, we were finding out what other people were doing. So the stars really aligned. And I was just a small part of it. My role really, to be true, was just to bring a vision. That was the biggest contribution. I just put something out there that made sense to some of the leaders in our organization, and they trusted the vision enough to pursue it, and they made it the reality.
Okay. With what you just stated, what are your standards and non-negotiables as fire chief?
Oh man. Well, you know, my non-negotiables is doing the things that we should be doing, you know, and I know now there's a big kick to stop wearing your gear, but, you know, we're always going to turn out, and you know, the saying, it's on fire till we say it's not on fire. It's not out till we say it's occupied. So it's, I'm a huge mission guy. So I guess my first non-negotiable is neglecting the mission. We're the mission's going to be first. And that, I love firefighters. My sons are firefighters, but we're here to serve a public, and the public comes first. And by God, if you're going to be a part of this organization, we're going to let you know that, so you don't make a mistake and join. If you want this to be more about you, Colony Fire Department's not the place for you. So that kind of, you know, kind of that, duty, respect, integrity are our core values. I take those very, man, I see red when I hear of bullying, when I hear of harassment, and I know that goes on in firehouses, but they're not going to go on in our firehouses. And, you know, the salty guys are sitting out there that love to screw with guys every single day. You know, they're going to say, well, I'm just buying into the entitlement and the putrefaction of the fire service. Hey, I'll own that. But we're all adults. So I have a really a hard line in the sand about bullying, about physical abuse, about harassment. Now, there's firehouse jocularity, so we got to draw a line. I mean, we're a tribe, and I believe there has to be a trust built. You know, I hate when we associate ourselves with the military, because, you know, the military, the Marine Corps, they do a great job of breaking people down, but they never build them back up. And the fire service, we're experts at breaking people down, and then we leave them a crying mess over in the corner sucking their thumb, and we don't build them back up. We're getting a different person in the fire service. We're not getting the Vietnam vets. We're not getting, you know, a lot of those that have had those experiences. And so we got to think a little differently. So that's a line in the sand. You know, we're going to be aggressive problem solvers. We're going to train. You know, if we miss a day of training, I get it because we're tired, but we're not going to miss more than one or two. I'm really committed to those things. You know, treating people with respect, going out the door and having compassion for the people that we treat. You know, we're not going to treat the homeless person any different. We are the person that's going to, you know, that lives in the mansion. So I guess those are my lines. And what was the first part of the question? I spent kind of the start of
I asked about your standards and non-negotiables.
Okay. So those are kind of my, you know, we're going to treat each other like human beings. And now that doesn't mean this job's for everybody. We let people go on probation. That does not mean that everybody is welcome here to be a firefighter, but we're going to give you every chance to be successful, put forth the effort. And if you meet the standard, which we'll talk about next, then you're going to be here. So those are kind of my lines. We're not going to increase our status or popularity at the expense of somebody else. I don't like individual agendas. People with individual agendas are troublemakers. This is a team sport. Now, everybody has situations at home that they have to deal with. But, you know, if I want to mold this organization for my personal agenda, I'm going to get involved in that. We're going to shut it down pretty quick. Another line in the sand before I go to my standards operationally is I want all three shifts to act very similar. Now, different part of town, you may have to have different response packages and plans, you know, if you're a high rise industrial, but if you have multiple shifts, all three of those shifts should function the same. I don't allow this. Well, you know, we want to use this hose line, so we're going to change it this morning, and we want to use this air pack, so we're going to, and the rigs are getting changed every day. You know, I'm sure people have a good argument for that. And I'll be happy to debate it, but that's one of my lines. As far as my standards, we're going to go out the door. We're going to look like firemen. We're going to be dressed and we're going to dress down. We're going to show up ready to go to work. Preparedness, mental, physical, mechanical, procedural is one of our standards. I hope that's on the front of everybody's mind as they walk into our firehouse. Their head's going to be right, mental, their body, physical, mechanical, our stuff, and they understand our playbook, which is FOG 510. So preparedness is a big one. We're going to train. We're going to be aggressive problem solvers, and I'm going to give you all the tools and support I can to do that. But we're going to remember that every time we go out the door, it's somebody's family. It's their kids, their parents, their brothers or sisters. And we're going to deliver the same level of service that we would expect to show up at our houses while we're at the firehouse if our wives called the fire department. So that's, then we have a lot of we have a lot of performance standards, you know, mask up time. We now have a department wide mask up time of under 30 seconds. That's a standard. Wow. We do company preparedness drills where we're stretching lines and we have have a time for. So we have a lot of those performance standards. But as far as my leadership standards, everybody I promote understands we're here to serve the men and women of the organization. It's not about us. Now, I'm not a big believer in the true definition of servant leadership, because I've read a lot of stuff and I experienced things that it's not a great fit in a paramilitary organization, those parts of us that do fit the military. But I would say we are a servant leadership, but not to be servant leaders. We do it to produce a better product out on the road. And so that's one of my standards. I believe in putting the best people in the best spot. You know, I know the fire service is all about fairness and plug and play, but the stuff we do is too important. So that's why we've created kind of this engine, truck, and squad, so we can put like-minded people together who have the same level of passion and commitment, and they develop the product of teams. So those are kind of just a few of my standards and line in the sand. Okay. My guys will probably tell you I have a lot more that I don't realize I have, but those are the ones that I recognize.
Okay. And the one thing that stuck out to me is you stated, you know, you have three shifts and they're all the same. It's not the Colony Fire Department, but A, B, and C are three different type. You know, they uh-uh. act differently.
That's one of my big lines in the saying. And when I created the battalion chief's position, and as recently as our last captain's camp, I said, how many times have I told you we need to be more alike than differently because of this reason, because of this problem that occurred? I think you can't say you're positioning your people for success and survival if they work at Firehouse One and they catch an overtime shift on B shift or blue shift or however you call your shifts. And the first thing the senior man says is, let me show you how we do it on this shift. You know, what have you just done to my confidence? What, do I not know how to do it? And so I'm causing somebody to, just because of an opinion, or a philosophy, there's nothing other than, well, that's just the way we like to do it over here. That's not going to say. Now, a lot of departments do it and get away with it, and that's great. But the minute I hear a department say, well, we got five stations, three shifts, and 15 different ways of doing anything, that tells me they have no standards.
All right. Well said. I had no debate on that. The next topic I'd like to talk about is chief officer and company officer leadership. You obviously have a standard, you have a vision, and you have made that vision come into fruition with the way you treat the colony. But what's your take on leadership? Like, you know, we have company officers out there who are just doing the bare minimum, or they want the position just for the title, things of that nature.
And you know, we're always going to kind of have those. If I said, I said in the class that you said, and if I could do the perfect promotional process to get either a chief officer or a company officer, number one, I would want to be able to measure their relevance. Now, we can do that. We give written tests and tacticals and exercises, but relevance in this job is hugely important. You can't fake knowledge, skills, abilities. You just can't. A lot try. And you're not going to be fully respected unless you know how to do this job. You may be liked and everybody might kid with you, but if you ask them, who do you want to go on a line with or be in a fire with? And it's not that guy. So being relevant to where you bring something to the table. I want to know how you address problems and solve problems. I want to know how you're going to keep the people that look to you for leadership engaged in the day to day, but also motivate them to get a little bit better. I want to know your philosophy on managing risks. You know, or are you just a safety guy and you're not going to take any risk, or you know, how is that going to work? And then the last one is, how do you react when things don't go your way? I can tell you more about a chief officer, a company officer, a shift commander. I can tell you more about their leadership when they're in crisis or when things don't go their way than any other time. Anybody can lead during easy times. That's, you know, if everybody's dialed in and tuned up and into it, leadership is somewhat easy. So those are the things that I would test. So those are the things that are important to me. But the first thing is the knowledge, skills, abilities, and attitudes to do the job. We have to make sure that is there. And then we have to make sure really both, even though, you know, fire chiefs and company officers, you got to be effective supervisors first. You got to know how to run either the fire department business or the firehouse business or the shift business. Now, I don't say that to compare us to the private sector, but there's things that we got to kind of do every day to keep us out of the courtroom, keep us out of the media. And that's the day-to-day business stuff, filling out the reports, the timesheets, you know, doing the day-to-day. And so that's a big part of it. And then we transition into leadership, and everybody is a leadership in their own way, is a leader in their own ways. We practice leadership every day, but specifically, I want to look at their strategic leadership, their tactical leadership, and then their crisis leadership. Those are the leadership strengths and weaknesses I want to understand, because you're always, as a fire officer, you're always thinking either strategically, tactically, or you're in crisis mode. So that's what I want to kind of know about. And I think we sometimes put too much pressure on our officers to be great leaders, but they got to be supervisors and operators first before, and leadership will come out of that a long ways, a lot of, but if you fail there, if you're not an operator and you're not a supervisor, effectively, you're going to struggle in your leadership role. And so that's all important. And then the last thing I really want to know is, what are you going to invest and sacrifice? The higher you go, the more you have to invest and sacrifice for your city, your fire department, for your people. That has to be a big part of it. And I think if any one of those is not talked about or is not part of the big picture, then leadership is going to suffer. I think one of the biggest problems fire service officers struggle with in terms of leadership are two things. They don't have a vision that they can clearly communicate, and and discovery. They don't understand their personal leadership and operational philosophy, to a point where every time, you know, as a company officer, as a chief officer, every time we interact with the troops, we're sharing our operational and leadership philosophy. We're sending a message, even in an informal environment. But the more I understand that, the more I can understand that message and what the men and women that look to me for leadership are hearing. And I think those are two areas where officers struggle. Hopefully they're relevant. You know, hopefully they got the knowledge and skills, but they just don't have a vision. And if you don't have a vision, what are you working towards every day? You know, if I don't know what success looks like as your boss, how can I tell you, how can I coach you and mentor you to be better if I don't know what the right way looks like? So I think those, they're pretty basic, but I think a lot of times we miss that in a fire service, and we start thinking up here when we haven't really gotten it right at the micro level.
Understood. With you saying that, it kind of sparked a notion in my head. You know, we will spend 9 months to a year designing an apparatus, but there are places in this country where for officer development, it's, we give you a test, you do an assessment. Yep. Okay, here's your company, here are your bugles, go forth and prosper. But we're not doing anything to help develop that person.
No. And we can do a better job in the colony. We've been talking for about 4 years. 5 years on an initiative that I came out to the organization. This was right before COVID, and said, I want us to develop a world-class suburban fire officer development program. And we started talking about it, and we were going to call it Trumpets One and Trumpets Two. These are speaking trumpets, not bugles. And if you go back to the Bible, you can find out what appear anyway. But so that's where it came from. So we wanted to do officer development thing prior to promotion for senior men and apparatus officers, apparatus operators, and then Trumpets Two would be after promotions. And so it would be those two things. And we would look at a lot of, emotional intelligence, understanding people. You know, I'm not so worried about time management and all those things that are in the typical deals, but you know, how do you solve problems? How do you deal with the generations? How do you help people overcome the stress and anxiety of just going to work? All those things. And we can all do better. Some do pretty good, but probably the number one need in the American fire service, you know, other than staffing internally, is probably a good time-tested officer development program. And it can't just be a one-time thing. It's like anything else. you got to have, you know, if I could make this thing work, we would do trumpets one and trumpets two. And then we would have camps throughout the year. We call them captain's camps, but kind of little shorter 1 or 2 day refreshers, and focus on maybe one component of what came out of trumpets one and two. And so we start to develop action steps. So we just don't tell you what we want you to be. We're able to show you what that looks like.
Okay. It's also, in my opinion, that the most successful departments, whether volunteer, career, part-time, whatever the case may be, they have great communication amongst the rank and file, top, bottom, bottom, top. What's your take on being an effective department, but essentially having great communication?
Man, you know, every place I've ever been and every survey that's ever been taken, it always comes back. We got to improve communications. Probably another area that we can do better in, but I think we got to step back a little bit. Firefighters have a lot of time on their hands in a lot of situations. You know, if you're running a busy inner city engine company, but most of us, you know, we're making a fair amount of calls, but we have a fair amount of downtime, right? And so when we have that downtime, and because we're all type A personalities and we're curious, we want to know the answers to everything. I'd love to give the answers to everything, but I can't communicate every decision I make, and I right. can't ask for input. And so I think we got to kind of manage that. I think is, you know, either through newsletters or staff meetings or whatever, we can always do a better job in communications. Now, you know, the way I look at it is I spend a tremendous amount of time. I mean, multiple times a day with my assistant chiefs and my division chiefs. That's who I mentor. That's who I coach. That's who I really help understand the vision. And then I rely on them to go to their direct reports, my ops chief to go to his battalion chiefs, my EMS division chief to go to his single role paramedics and pass the message on. And then I expect the captains to go to their firehouses and do the same, right? To me, that's a healthy community. Now, there's opportunity for biases to enter into some of the message, and some get it done and some don't. I get all that. So I think there has to be some redundancy in some of that communication, but, you know, I think the more I can get in the firehouse, the better. You know, I can send it out with my assistant chief all day long, but there's certain things that the men and women want to hear from the fire chief. Mm-hmm. And so I need to make myself available. I can do a better job on that, but I don't want to be in the firehouse too often, because then I'm going to come across as a micromanager, and I don't trust them and I don't believe in what they're doing. So, I mean, we can always do better. But I think what you got to do is step back and say, am I doing good enough? And are the people that are asking for better community, is it one and two, or is it the whole organization? There's always going to be a few that they're always going to want more.
Okay. Understood. My next question for you, I have, and I really want to hear your take on it. The colony at one point, was your department doing 24/48s?
Uh-huh.
Okay, so that's, you know, the schedule debate within the country is kind of wild, but I really want to hear your take on switching from the 24/48 to the 48/96. Is there a benefit? Numbers show that there is a benefit when it's broken down.
Yeah, but also remember this. You can make numbers say anything you want to say.
This is true.
You can, and I know that for a fact, okay? So there's a couple things. I always worked 24/48. I worked in busy fire companies. I always worked on my days off. I raised two kids. I had a family. I made it work. You know, I'm 62 years old today. I'm still able to do some stuff. So I guess I missed all the terrible things that were going on that I should have been experiencing. I mean, I'm doing okay. And if you had to ask me again, I would want to do that. I don't want to spend 48 hours in a firehouse. That's just me. And I love my guys. I loved going to the firehouse, but I don't want to do 48s. But that's my personal bias. So mm-hmm. The first time it came up, and are we on any kind of time frame? Because this is kind of a long, is a long little expect, but I know it's of interest to a lot of people.
Yes, go ahead.
So the first time I started to hear about it, there was only one other department near us. I don't know statewide, but there was only one other department near us that had done it when it came to me. And so I asked my association president, I said, let's go out and see what the interest is. And it was about 40%. And I said, you know, that's just not enough for me to go to my boss. So we kind of put it on the back burner for maybe a year or two. We had other things going on. Now, it's still, there weren't a lot of other departments jumping on it. But my president came back to me and said, hey, we would like to look at this again. So the same thing. Well, he came back this time, and I want to say there was about 78% interest. So I said, okay, well, that's enough for me. If the chief realizes there's 78% of his or her organization is interested in something, regardless if you adopt it, you better look at it. You better give it some time, because that's probably not going to go away. So I said, all right. So I started calling, learning, get my heads in the, and by that, at that time, there was very, very, very little on it, very little. But the big thing, I went to my boss and said, hey, we're thinking about doing this. You know, when he said, as long as it doesn't cost us any money, he's okay with it. So, I went back and forth, and the morning I approved it on a Friday morning, and I'll be honest with you, I was against it up until the day that I approved it. And I'll tell you why I approved it is we were getting ready to open two firehouses. And I knew that if we didn't accept that, the candidacy pool for those firehouses would have looked much different. I was also concerned that I was going to start losing some really good members as more and more departments started to move to this, and I didn't want to lose any. So that was really my motivation for doing it. Now, at that time, yeah, I read Project Mayday, where I saw that, you know, there's a greater number of Maydays and incident and accidents on a second 48. Okay, I get it. I looked at what there was, sleep study. You know, I talked to Bobby Halton. A lot of people may or may not know, but Albuquerque Fire went to 4896. I think it was in the mid 80s or late 80s, early 90s, a long time ago. Well, Bobby Halton was still in operations, and Bobby was adamantly against it in Albuquerque. And he tells the story that after they went to it, he wrote a letter to the organization apologizing, saying, hey, I was wrong. So based on my respect with Bobby, having that conversation with him, Rick Lasky had just went to an organization where they were moving to 4896. So, you know, there was a lot of opinion out there, but I went to the people that I trusted and asked them about their experience. So we made the move. And to be honest with you, you know, the Colony Fire Department still operates great today. I think our guys are happier. Out of 100 members, we have about three or four that don't like it. Mm-hmm. The rest seem to like it. We're able to attract people from farther away because, you know, that they can, the drive is different. They've all told me that their home life has improved. They're nobody has said that isn't a huge. So we know that works, the days off. So then we got to talk about the 48 hours in the firehouse, right? We're a suburban department. We're not crazy busy. You know, our ambulances will make 10 to 12 calls in a 24-hour shift. So they're going to double that in two shifts. But our turnaround is very close. The hospitals are right there. So that's not a big problem. Our medical control physician, he measures 32 metrics every month on our EMS delivery. We have not seen anything negative in how our paramedics perform of those 32 metrics since we went 4896. We have not seen an increase in accidents on the second day. We have not seen an increase in damaged equipment in the second day. We're still kind of coming out of COVID, so we don't have a real good year-long on the numbers about what does it do to sick time and overtime and all those other things. But we haven't seen any spikes in it. And I have some members now that are very well respected. We have a great relationship. They love the culture, but they said, Chief, if we go back, we're going to go find another organization. They really love it. So a lot of positives. Now let's talk about maybe some of the negatives. I don't get to see my battalion chiefs as much, but we talk on the phone. They don't mind that. So that's not a big deal. We bring in a lot of outside instructors. So like we're getting ready to bring Lieutenant Tim Klett in from FDNY. Okay. He's going to come in and do a 3-day class, but he's got to be with us for 4 days. to get that done. So we have to pay our instructors an extra day to be there. We've had to do that a couple times. No big deal. It's a little bit of a challenge to get some people to come in on day two of the tour, on the second shift of the tour. If somebody has to go home and now you got to bring somebody in from home, outside of that, it's not a problem. We allow our guys to work 72 hours. If they have to work any more than that, it requires chief's approval, but I haven't had to make that decision in a while. So we manage that. Now, as far as the day today, when we pass this, because we're a heavy training organization, my expectation was I want the first day to look like the second day. In other words, we're not going to bust our ass before noon the first day and not do anything for the rest of the tour. But there's some fluctuation in that. So, you know, I'm at a firehouse with the battalion chief and an engine company, so I get to see what goes on. Our daily routines are pretty much the same. If a company gets hammered at night, I expect the officer to allow them to sleep in the next morning or take that time. You know, if we have to put them up at a slower firehouse to get some recovery, we allow them to do that. From 11, it's either 11 to 1 or 11 to 2. I think it's 11 to 1 each day. We don't plan any administrative stuff. And so that's their time to take a nap. We do something called a level 10. It's a citywide staff meeting. And I went to all the directors and I told them, I said, listen, if you walk in a firehouse during these hours, you're going to see the guys asleep. And I'm just telling you right now, because they're here for 48 hours where we run a lot at night. And so I got that out of the way, because that's one of the things you got to worry about, you know, IT or facilities coming in at 3 o'clock in the afternoons, everybody and firemen don't just nap. They got to have their blanket with them and their woobie and their slippers on, and the AC's got to be at 42 degrees. So it's exaggerated to the, it's not just a quick nap. So, but you know, you're proactive and all those, but I mean, so we haven't seen, now I'll tell you something I'm watching, and you know, people won't like me letting this out because they'll think it's weaponizing 4896, but I'm going to tell the truth, the good and the bad. And I've told you it's all good. But one of the things I'm worried about, I'm curious to see if drinking is going to increase. And if you're a young single fireman, you're going to go out the night that you get off work. You're hopefully not going to hit it too hard the night before you go into the firehouse. So now I got 3 nights to go out with my friends and party and drink. Is that a big deal? If you're mature and control it, no. But if you can't, there's a possibility. I mean, I even hear my senior guys, what are you going to do today? I'm going to get home to the shop. I'm going to open me a bottle of beer and I'm going to be drinking beer for the next 4 days. Okay. Could it be a big deal? I don't know. The next thing I'm a little worried about is, you know, we got a lot of young firefighters who are single, and if they don't have a good support system and they have a bad call, now they're off for 4 days before they get to come back to their crew. And, you know, whenever I experienced something that bothered me, I wanted to get back with the guys in the firehouse, and we all just got through it together. Well, now I'm off 4 days to think about it. I'm drinking and now it's just going to be a lot worse. So that's kind of my take on it. You know, I just wish firefighters were excited about getting better at their job as they are excited about changing the schedule that they work. And man, you got guys that are all in there doing the research. Oh, I want to see all the math about it. And you ask them what the friction loss on their hose is, and they can't even tell you what the nozzle is, but boy, they can give you all the stats about 4896. That disappointed me just a little bit.
Oh, Chief, love it. And the thing is, it's funny, but it's very true. It's very true. I mean, you got some that are dialed in, but some that it seems to be like their priorities are all out of whack. We worry about salary, but we want the chief to go fight for us, but in return, when he watches us at a structure fire or an incident, we look terrible, but yet we're like, we want more money and benefits. It's like, there's give and take. We got to show the man or woman in charge why we want these things. Because to me, fire comes first. It's what we're here for.
We all tried so hard to get a fire job, and now I got it, and I'm looking for more and more reasons not to come to work. I mean, I just don't get it. You know why? But yeah, it's a different generation. Yeah, but man, yeah. I went my first 6 years. I never took a sick day. I never took a day off sick till I had kids. Then that all changed. But I would get a ribbon every year for not. I wanted to go to the firehouse. I enjoyed my time off to rest and relax with my family. But man, okay, I'm in a firehouse today. And you would have upset me if you said, I can't go back to work for how long? 4 days? Oh, it's a different time.
Yes, sir. Okay. With that being said, the topic of, you kind of mentioned a little bit, wellness and truly being there for one another. You know, the term brotherhood, and you've heard it, it's going around. But I think it's a term that is being used too often, because when a situation dictates for, hey, we should check on this individual, how are they doing? We have a, what I would say, like a systemic failure when it comes to that.
Now, I will tell you this, the Colony Fire Department does an excellent job, the men and women, and I can do better in that, but across three shifts, it looks, but our guys are very responsive. This is what's interesting. If we have somebody get sick or hurt today, our guys, they'll go all in and do whatever they can. They really will. They're great about it. But man, if I start an IA today, they're going to be poking each other in the eye, pointing, he did this, he did that, he did this. So this is the way I look at the brotherhood and the sisterhood, and I compare it to friendship. You know, those that have brothers and sisters, you probably went a period of time where you didn't like them. You probably hated your brother or sister. You may not have liked them, but you never wanted to see them fail. So because of that, you weren't afraid of hurting their feelings. So you got up and you told them what they needed to hear. You know, hey, you're messing up. If you continue down this road, there's nothing but bad news. You know, I'm truly worried about you because you're part of my family and I don't want you to screw up. To me, the brother and sisterhood is not as much about doing and giving as it is having the courage to correct somebody who's going down the wrong road. I mean, you know, I love going to benefits and getting the t-shirts and giving $100 for this and doing that and honoring down, you know, fallen firefighters. And if I can help somebody and do it, you know, I'm all in on that. That's a part of it. But the more difficult part is, hey, I see you're struggling. I got to have the courage to have that conversation. And to me, that's truly the sign of brother and sisterhood. The people that I call when I'm having a hard time, I know I can trust. They're not going to betray me when I go in and I share something with them. They're not going to share it with the firehouse. They're not going to make fun of me when I leave. There's a certain amount of security between the two of us. I trust you. You trust me. And so, you know, those guys in the firehouse who talk about other people or bash other people or, you know, I don't, when they talk brother and sisterhood, it just goes in. To me, I've got a very clear idea in my head what being a brother or sister in the American Fire Service looks like. And it has nothing to do with t-shirts, stickers, or my beliefs. It has to do with my actions, but more importantly, my convictions. And so, you know, I will travel great lengths to go to a funeral or go to help somebody in need, but I would do those same things if I had to get out there and correct them because I knew they were making a very poor life choice and somebody has to tell them and nobody's had the courage to do it yet. But yeah. The American Fire Service is a very selective brother and sisterhood, and it's more about cliques and those kind of things, and we allow that to happen. I mean, we allow that to happen. But you know, I love those company officers that do a good roll call, and then when it's time to sit down at the table, they demand that we spend 30 minutes being a family, and they're not allowing everybody to be on their cell phones and all those other distractions And you know, trying to, because some of us, if we didn't grow up in that setting, you know, both our parents worked and it was always, you know, mom's giving us leftovers or bringing something home from her first job to her second job. We never had that. So if we want that family environment, we got to show them what that looks like. And the other thing we got to do is generation coming in is we got to remember a lot of these young men and women never were in Boy Scouts. They never played an organized sport. So they don't know what a brother sisterhood looks like. So we got to teach them that just like everything else. And I'll tell you a quick story example. Jerry Wells, who I have tremendous respect for, he was a battalion chief in Louisville, good friend. And we had a lot of retirements and we were bringing in some new guys. And he got very upset because the new guys weren't going to the retirement ceremonies. And so Jerry addresses a problem. He's not going to hold back. So he brought all these guys together and he started to kind of say, hey, you need to come to these. Well, the reason why the new hires weren't going is they felt like they didn't belong there. They're brand new and they felt like they hadn't earned their spot. And so they weren't going. And so Jerry said, no, just go and sit in the corner, stand in the corner. Don't say anything. Just your appearance is enough. All he had to do is explain that to him. And he never had a problem again. So there was just a miscommunication thing there. So we say live the brotherhood. We got to tell our people what that looks like if they've never been in an organization or experienced a brotherhood, we got to teach that to them.
No, very
you can't well expect stated. Them just to know it.
Yes, you're right. You're right. Well said. Well said. As we wrap up this interview, Chief, because I know you're super busy, I do want to ask. I usually like to ask the guests, where would you like to see yourself, or you know, before you retire? And a lot of them say company officer, some sort of chief role. The
can
chief.
I still say that? I'd like to see me as a back tailboard fireman or company officer. Okay, I'll take those.
But you know, with that being said, I mean, so this is going to be my opinion, and I think a lot of what I call the two percenters would agree. Chief, I've heard you on plenty other, you know, Corley's podcast, and the way you talk, the way you speak, the way you teach, what you try to emulate, you are what I dub, you are America's fire chief.
Well, thank you for that. Not deserving, but thank you.
But I mean, you talked about moving the needle forward. That's, you had that vision. And to me, you have done that. So with that being said, when you do retire, when you decide to hang it up, what's the next steps for you?
One of the biggest mistakes I've made to this point is I don't have an exit plan. And I would recommend any young man or woman getting into this, have your goals, but I don't have an exit plan. But again, I got to give a little bit of a story. When I was trying to get a job, I tested a couple places, and I was, and I've told this story a couple times, but I went to take the Plano test. And before I went in, I sat in my car and prayed to my God. I said, just give me a fire job and I'll do 40 years. So the first part of that is my turn to pay back now. So I would like to do 40 years, and January 6th will be the start of 39. So that's what I'd like to, or excuse me, be completed, be the start of 40. So I'm going to go to January of 2027 is kind of my goal. So I want to do 40 years. I want to stay involved writing. I would like to write another book, kind of a little different thing, but toying with that. Any one time now, and I got a full schedule, but I'm trying to mentor 10 officers at any time. I do five. I do every other week. So 1 week I'll do five. The next week I'll do five, and I donate an hour of my time with them and talk about whatever they want to talk about. I'd like to continue that. I'd like to continue and travel, I think. But you know, that's kind of it. And just hope that, you know, I put out that mentor packet. That's something I tried to get out to the American Fire Service, maybe do some things like that, that they're not complex, but at the same time, they're free. But I guess just going forward, to answer your question, maybe just to continue to look for opportunities to influence, however big or small that I can, until, you know, I don't ever see myself totally stepping away from it. I may change my mind if I'm not physically capable, but always writing, hopefully always doing podcasts, you know, contributing in some way, but I don't know. I want another chief job. I'm not going to pursue another chief's job. You're not going to see me go to another fire department and be a fire chief. I don't think I want to be a sales rep for a fire company. I don't think I want to do that. I'm talking to some teach training agencies, maybe doing some contract training, teaching for something like that. But that's probably what I'm going to do.
Okay. And with all your successes, with how you've implemented programs within the colony, I'm sure you have your fair share of what we call haters. And, you know, if anybody in the fire service is trying to do anything positive above the norm, but they're surrounded by those that feel intimidated, what's your advice to them, you know, regarding pushing forward?
You got to put things into context, but you know, we're all individuals and we all have values and principles and character, and it's a shame. You know, you truly do learn as you get older, and I probably didn't fully understand this till I was maybe in my 50s and got to work with a bunch of different individuals. But what's the saying? If you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything. Mm-hmm. The more time you spend in this job right now, people don't commit to things because they don't have the confidence to commit to it. They don't know enough about it, and they're afraid of being called out, afraid of being wrong. I get that. We all are, you know. I'll send out little stuff and I don't really think about it. Some just a word I use, you know, somebody will attack me about it. Yeah, I get it. But you got to decide the minute you walk in this job, is it going to be just a job, or is it going to be a career? And are you going to invest in it, or are you just going to experience it? You know, just go through the 40 years, 20 years, whatever, get your paycheck, there's nothing wrong with that, but that's a decision you have to make. You know, as I would say this to those that are starting their career, as I get to the end of mine, I would hate to think of the mindset that I would be in if I didn't take advantages that this job has given me. In other words, I feel sorry for those poor souls who are going to spend 20 or 30 years doing this and never gave it anything when they could have. And when somebody asks you, what did you do for the majority of your life? And you said, I was a firefighter, but that's all you can say. That just scares me if I would have chosen that path. And there's going to be a lot of those. And especially if you get a son or a daughter that gets into it and they're going to ask you what you did, well, you did your time. But we got to have room for those people. So, man, I would just say figure out, you know, what you want to do. And I said this yesterday on something, you know, the amount of love you give to this job is the amount of love you're going to get back. But I now understand when I wasn't doing anything or saying anything, I didn't have any haters, but I wasn't comfortable there. So I chose to get out in the public. You know, I started putting stuff on social media. Nobody made me do that. And I knew the first time I hit send, I used to write a lot of articles online, just put them out there. I knew the minute I had sent, I was going to get people that didn't agree. But as I started my class, if I can get somebody to agree or disagree with me, that's learning. I'm not going for agreeance. I'm not trying to win an army of like-minded people. I'm trying to challenge people's thought processes. And I want people to discover their truth, what they're willing to fight for, what they're willing to be criticized for, what they're willing to be hated for. But I'll tell you, this is true. I have never, ever, 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 ever been criticized by anybody who's doing more than me. Not once. Not once. Has anybody who's doing more than me in the fire service, now, they've offered me advice, but they've offered me advice to make me better, not to beat me down, not to stop me. The ones who do more are doing more than me are giving me words to help me get better. Only the ones that are doing less do I hear from. And they resent me because they don't get asked to teach at FDIC. You know, the minute you write a book, people hate you just for writing a book because you cross over from being that somebody to. So, I mean, just think about that. How stupid is that for somebody not to like somebody because they wrote a book and they have no idea the effort, but until they write a book, I'm not going to listen to them because they don't know people who criticize fire chiefs. I can't get upset about that because they've never done a job of fire chief. I put myself in a position. And the minute I realize the fire chief represent all evil, I sleep better at night. I'm going to have to make the decisions I make. So I now, like I say, I kind of embrace that. And the more people that have problems with me, man, I'm getting free rent in their head. If I'm impacting them to there's got to be some truth to it. If there wasn't, they would just write it off and forget about it. But there's something that they're either feeling shame, they're feeling guilt, they're feeling anger. For whatever. And so, I'm not going to adjust what I'm doing. And you look at every great leader, you know, the ones that stepped out there and for a purpose, the people that got assassinated, the people that got rockstone, the people that got locked up for 40 years for speaking their mind, right? That's not easy things. But when you believe in something enough, you're willing to pay a price. You're not willing to pay a price for your beliefs. Are they worth anything then?
Right. Right. And with that being said, that's the perfect way to end this. Chief, I truly, truly appreciate it. I love the fact that I was able to meet you in person.
That was cool.
It was a hell of a class. I got to listen to Scott Thompson for 7 hours. It was fantastic. It was intimate, one-on-one. Chief, sincerely, thank you. Don't ever change. Continue doing what you're doing. I know you will. And I truly appreciate you accepting this offer.
Well, and thank you for having me on. Thank you for what you're doing, man. You're putting yourself out there and spreading the word, but keep pushing and keep going. And we're going to make this a little better than where we found it.
Absolutely.
Thank you for having me on.
Yes, sir.
If any of the listeners out there are or know of a great firefighter who embodies the principles of being a great communicator, goal-oriented, hardworking, humble, passionate, and professional, regardless of rank, career or volunteer, contact me at studentofthegamefirepodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, stay focused, stay committed, and stay safe.